Thanks for taking the time to download this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast. To search for other podcasts you might like, click bbc.co.uk/5live, where you'll also find our terms of use.
Hello, Outriders. This week we look at some of the problems that netizens are facing when it comes to access and sharing online. SOPA, the Stop Online Piracy Act, and PIPA, Protect IP bills, have been making headlines from the United States where the bills were designed, and of course all over the web where protesters showed their views on this sort of legislation being passed. The two bills were designed to stop the distribution of copyright material, or to stop people sharing material that they're not supposed to, and viewing material that they have not paid for. It's a tricky topic, as there are many protesters raising their voices against the laws, and there are plenty of people who support the ideas too. Along with these headlines about legislation in America, there are many other places around the world that are debating how best to manage a population that has an increasing presence on the internet. In India, a court case is continuing that may affect how social networking websites work, not in relation to copyright material, but as a reaction to offensive content being spread and shared. So what do they mean by offensive content, and who are the big names in this case? Well, friend of Outriders, Nishant Shah, is the co-founder and director of research at the Bangalore-based Centre for Internet and Society. He gave us the lowdown.
This is an extremely complicated story, because this one case is only the tip of the iceberg. I'm going to try and simplify it and break it into three bits to make sense of what's happening to the internet, but also what's happening to the internet within the social context of India. So in 2011, India passed an amendment on intermediary liability, which was kind of an addition to the existing Information Technology Acts of 2008. It sounds really scary, but I'm going to kind of simplify it, right? So according to the intermediary liability amendment, the different intermediaries, which is ranging from your internet service providers to platforms that give access to information and host information, were liable for sensitive, provocative, or obscene information which would do harm to the society, which technically means that if I find something offensive personally, and hence I think that it is offensive to a larger public as well, I can send a takedown notice to the intermediary hosting that information, and then they have the prerogative of taking down that information from their platforms. So let me give an example. I personally find images of people playing with their dogs very offensive. If I do, then I can presume that there must be a whole lot of people whose moral sensitivities or aesthetic sensibilities are offended by pictures of dogs playing with people. And then I can actually send takedown notices to YouTube. And if YouTube thinks I am making a valid point, all videos of people playing with dogs shall be taken down. Now, I know that it sounds ridiculous, because surely an intelligent system made of human beings, who of course all love dogs because everybody loves dogs, YouTube would just laugh at me and ignore my request. So we did a little experiment saying that if we did send out notices to people, what would happen? The presumption was, hopefully, that we would imagine that the companies would try to discourage people from going berserk and making it into a weekend game where they get drunk in groups and flag unreasonable requests for material online. So we did exactly that for our experiment. We actually sent unreasonable takedown notices to several intermediaries in the country. And it was a shock to us that almost unanimously, without any resistance or pushback, the content we flagged was taken down because the intermediaries naturally would want to play it safe rather than suffer from prosecution for hosting content which might be potentially offensive. So we now have a regime where the court of law, which till now was the arbitrator that decided what was and was not offensive, is no longer the sole adjudicator in the scene, and that private companies and intermediaries can exercise information filtering and censorship on information. So this is the first step. The second step is that in the later half of 2011, Dr. Kapil Sibal, who is right now the Minister of Communication and Information Technologies in India, called some of the biggest social networking sites like Facebook, Twitter, Microsoft, and Google for a meeting where he showed them content which was non-congratulatory, to say the least, abusive, to Mrs. Sonia Gandhi, the leader of the political party, the Indian National Congress, which is right now in government. Just to clarify, Mrs. Gandhi is not our prime minister, but she is the head of the largest ruling party in the coalition government. So Dr. Sibal gave takedown notifications to Facebook, Twitter, Microsoft, Google, and suggested a pre-censorship regime where these companies exercise human and technological monitoring of offensive content to stop it from coming into the public domain. These are conversations which are still going on right now on how to technologically implement this. But that's not the problem. The problem is defining what is correct and not. Is there a public morality code which is homogeneous? How will we decide what is offensive and what is not? What happens to censorship regimes where there is no power of negotiation left on the authors and publishers of information? So these conversations are still going on, but these are the two predecessors to what's happening about Facebook and Google in the Delhi court right now. It is now the third step which we are at right now, which is that while these conversations are still going on, recently a court case was registered in one of the lower courts in Delhi against Facebook and Google, and it presses civil and criminal charges against both these companies. They are both accused of very specific things. It has been said that these companies, despite pre-knowledge, allow for obscene and immoral material which incites prurience, communal tension, hatred and violence to proliferate in their systems because this helps them to make revenue. Right? This is a very serious accusation. It basically says that, yes, Google and Facebook both have certain kinds of terms of services to filter out material which might incite violence, hatred, prurience, immorality, corruption, and so on. Despite having that terms of service, despite having these kinds of surveillance mechanisms, they allow for these to proliferate because it helps them to generate revenue. The problem is that because the uploaders of the information are outside the jurisdiction of the court, they cannot be punished. But these intermediaries who have allowed for this content, which is deemed unacceptable and leading to corruption of public mind and morality, now need to be held responsible for this content. So this case was filed in the lower court and now has been escalated by the accused, Google and Facebook, who took it to the High Court of Delhi, where the court has allowed for the case to be filed. So this is how things stand today. What we're looking at is a new system of regulation, which is going to shape not only the ways in which we access information online, but also the production, regulation, distribution, and nature of what can and cannot be saved on the web.
Does this point to a sort of fundamental misunderstanding of how the internet works, I guess, to say that the responsibility with the platform, but of course the perpetrators of spreading this material, as you mentioned, are outside of the jurisdiction. It's enormously difficult to control.
I'm not sure if it's actually a misunderstanding about how the web works, but what it's really doing is it's bringing to our attention that what happens on the web, online, when you are on Facebook and when privacy policies change and so on and so forth, is a very small part of the larger regulation mechanism of the internet. Like, we all know that the web is distributed. It exists in a certain hyperspace, which cannot always be controlled by sovereign laws of one particular geography. But those are things for the users and not for the intermediaries and stakeholders. Most web companies fall under some jurisdiction or the other. I mean, a couple of years ago, we had the famous case of Google and China and how they had to shut down shop there and move to Hong Kong. Also, unlike the telephone, for instance, which exercises no censorship, control or curation on the information that's passing through the spectrum, these internet companies actually have terms of service which moderate and censor information through technological and human interventions. So they are performing a series of checks through different nodes so that they can not claim to be merely conduits of information, but they have to be recognized as publishers and hosts of this information. And they are being attributed now with what in the legal terminology is called malified intent, that they had knowledge about certain things which could be deemed harmful, and they have allowed it to come through. So what we have here now is a look at the web infrastructure and looking at what goes behind the user interfaces. So it isn't as much a misunderstanding of the web as bringing into very sharp focus the amount of regulation, jurisdiction, and control that happens at the level of infrastructure and intermediaries, which most of us generally are not aware of.
Do you think that this case will get thrown out in the end, or do you think they will actually come to some form of solution?
The thing is, they've cited a couple of things as obscene material or instances which have actually offended both the people who have filed the case as well as the court of law, right? So in the recent reading by the High Court, it mentions two things. One is that there are obscene and derogatory pictures of the Prophet Muhammad, of Jesus Christ, and various Hindu gods and goddesses that the court finds, and I'm quoting, obscene, lascivious, indecent, and shocking. Accompanied with that is degrading and obscene photographs of political leaders of different political parties in India with filthy language. So the thing is that this information is prone to lead to communal, emotional, political, moral, and personal tensions and crises in the eyes of the law. And it is offending sentiments, allegedly, of people across boards. And hence, it can no longer be protected by the doctrine of freedom of speech and expression, which is enshrined in the Article 19(1) of the Indian Constitution. Now that that freedom is no longer available to these companies, it is the prerogative of the court and the judge to decide whether the accusations in the charge are valid. And they will be evaluated not only through the existing IT Act and laws in the country, they will also be measured against what is considered offensive in the geopolitical and sociocultural space of India. Mm-hmm. So the case is going to show us the negotiations, regulations, control and containment of the digital infrastructure, which doesn't really feature on our everyday practice. And as it stands right now, the High Court has in Delhi has allowed for the case to be filed. So it's not being thrown out as something that is completely insane or just a knee-jerk reaction from people who might be more conservative or traditional in their outlook. It's kind of high time where, you know, the state is encountering the digital no longer at the level of Facebook changed its privacy policy or Google allowed more people to find you online, but it's going into hardcore questions of infrastructure ownership and information possession. And so the way we look at it, it's definitely not being thrown out. It's going to be fought and it's going to be a landmark case in the history of internet in India.
Do you think that more generally internet browsers in India, the customers who use the web daily, are aware of the implications of this case, or are they just hoping that things might carry on?
There hasn't been enough public discussion around the case and its implications, largely because the case hasn't matured enough in public imagination, right? But the way we look at it is that it's going to gain huge momentum, just like the SOPA and the PIPA did in the US. Mm-hmm. And when it goes into a discussion in the coming weeks, I think people are soon going to start realizing how it's going to change the way in which they understand and experience the internet.
In India, if people are prone to being offended by material or asking for things to be taken down, are there not already filters in place that people could use so that they don't have to see this sort of material?
There are always filters and mechanisms in place. There is a lot of legislation which already exists, which allows for people to flag information as sensitive or inappropriate, and hence it needs to be taken out of the public domain. But I think that that particular discussion about whether we can find technological solutions of putting out filters is a futile one. Because if the solution is not available today, it will be available tomorrow. And I think we need to make a distinction between what an intelligent information society is. If the conversations end at saying, introduce more law, introduce more censorship, introduce more technological solutions for filtering it, it makes us into a very stupid information society. Because it means that every potential rule and filter, without any sense of negotiation, will be implemented today. If India has to mature as an intelligent information society, it will be one that has to understand that what is at stake when information gets censored is that it informs how we live, it informs how we behave, how we connect to each other, and most importantly, how we think of ourselves as human beings. And that's what's at stake when it comes to questions of censorship in life.
So in which case does that also mean that if people are to learn when they're interacting with the internet, that in some cases you may have to put up with the bad along with the good?
Not only that, but you will also have to start looking at a more balanced perspective on how everything that you find bad might not be in itself bad. Mm-hmm. That there are multiplicity of perspectives and reading tropes which are available to different people, and that we now have to learn how to negotiate with information rather than just control it.
And so do you think this is a cultural difference then about the levels of responsibility when you see material that you don't like? I mean, most of us, when we've been browsing the web, will have shut down a window that we either didn't mean to open or didn't realise was going to be something that we didn't really want to see. But mostly people will tend to shrug this off and just not go back to that site or that page.
I wouldn't want to make a case for cultural exceptionalism for India, though it's the easiest thing to do. I'd much rather say that it has to do with the fact that in certain pockets of the world, and if you're going to compare it with England, for instance, the web has arrived with other kinds of markers of a liberal democracy. It has come with certain sense of education, of awareness, of sensibility, which allows for people to understand that this is not necessarily something that I subscribe to, but just because I don't subscribe to it doesn't make it wrong. But you have to realize that in India, the internet technologies came bundled with a certain sense of globalized invasion. There has been a certain kind of discourse ever since 2000, which has talked about how the internet is killing Indian culture or the Indian way of living. And so it introduces some people to the internet as something that's forbidden, that's dirty, that needs to be censored and controlled. And I think it is those responses which often come out in this kind of public discourse.
And how does that idea then stack against the fact that India's output when it comes to technology is outstanding? You know, it has great innovators and wonderful minds working on new technologies out of this country. In which case, to put that against the idea that the internet comes with a bad reputation seems a difficult crossover.
No, it actually fits in very well with India's own tensions with modernity. We have always had this problem about being traditional and being modern simultaneously. And what happened with the internet was that the mass penetration in, let's say, circles of production and labor were not matched by mass penetration in terms of cultural production and experience. So you have a lot of people who might be in the process of building the blocks of the internet, but the internet as a cultural phenomenon or a social experience is not necessarily a part of their everyday lives. And so there is this huge disconnect where on the one hand, the internet is a good thing because it's a part of India's development plans. It's a part of India's vision of what it wants to become in 2020. But at the same time, it's also looked upon as a technology which is invasive, which is destructive, and which is constantly kind of pulling out some of the fundamental social protocols that has defined Indian society.
Well, the case continues, and no doubt we'll be following along to find out how our Indian outriders may be affected. Last week also saw a huge story of the web as content sharing website Mega Upload was taken down and the site's owners were charged with copyright violation. As a response, the loose network of hackers and activists known as Anonymous activated their own takedown campaign targeting the Department of Justice, the FBI, and the Motion Picture Association of America. Many users of the Mega Upload site watched countless hours of video posted by other people with accounts on there, whether it was copyright material or otherwise. But the shutdown does not just mean that people are no longer able to watch videos, it also means that people who had put files on that site are currently unable to access them. One such customer is Jay Springett. He's a technology consultant, photographer, and musician. I asked him how he came to use the site.
I actually only signed up about 6 weeks ago because I got a message on Flickr from a filmmaker in the States who wanted to use my photos from my trip to Chernobyl and Pripyat for reference material. So I thought, I usually use a service called Dropbox to send files to people, but as I wanted to put links on my set on the website, I thought I'd use Mega Upload, and I uploaded the files there.
Had you heard about the site before? Because, I mean, a lot of people think of Mega Upload as a place to go to find something, to watch some content, rather than to upload necessarily.
I obviously used Mega Upload as brand recognition, being the biggest sort of site out there. But I think when it comes to just needing a place to upload files as a cyber locker, which is a technical term, I think, then I just used Mega Upload because it was the biggest site that I heard of.
How did you first hear that the site was being taken down?
On Twitter, actually, within minutes of it happening.
And what was your initial reaction?
I thought, wow, the day after the Pippa Soper protests when Wikipedia went dark, I thought that was quite a bold move for it to happen the next day.
When did you realise what this would mean for your material on that site?
Well, almost instantly, actually, because it was only a week ago that I deleted the files off of my computer because I needed some more space. And I thought, once I've sorted out my laptop, I'll just re-download them again. And obviously that's not going to happen now.
Do you know if there's anything in the terms and conditions that might say how you might be able to retrieve files?
Not as such. Being a normal human being, I didn't actually read the terms and conditions when I signed up. So I did try and go to the site after it was taken down, and obviously there's nothing there. It won't connect, so at this point, I can't even check the terms and conditions.
And has there been any notification to people who have accounts as to what might be happening?
Not as far as I'm aware. I personally haven't received anything.
Images from a trip to Chernobyl, that's unusual and valuable material, and obviously your memories are there too. Do you have backup copies anywhere?
Well, I have the backup copies of the JPEG files, but the files that I uploaded to Mega Upload were the actual raw files, which are the unprocessed files, which mm-hmm. take up a lot of space.
Has this changed the way you think about where you upload material? I mean, to choose Mega Upload, you've explained your reasons for adding links and other material. Would it make you think about adding material to places like YouTube or other areas where you can host some sort of material?
I think it's definitely sort of changed my mind about the idea of the cloud and having a service where you can upload all of your material to. Obviously, Apple's now offering one of those services. It's definitely changed my mind. I was thinking today, actually, as I was walking down the road, I walked past one of those big yellow storage companies. Essentially, sort of what's happened today is that I put something in the big box storage company, and then the police have demolished the building because they thought something inside was stolen. And if that can happen at any time, then it's definitely made me think twice about storing stuff only in the cloud and on the web.
Do you think it would make a difference, your decision about where to store things, as to whether or not a site holds material that may be considered copyright or that they shouldn't be hosting it? There are places and areas where you can put material that it isn't necessarily also a go-to place to watch a ripped copy of a film or something similar.
I completely agree. And obviously there are more services out there. However, even if you were to use maybe a less well-known service, I don't know what other users may be sharing on those websites. So, I mean, it could happen anywhere or at any time, I think.
What are your moves now? Have you tried to contact the company at all to see if you can try and get those files back?
I'm waiting to see on the internet if anyone else has done the same and whether they've had any luck, really. I have emailed the guy in the States asking him if I can have my files back.
Let's hope that he is able, or someone is able, to get back to you with an answer for that. But it's interesting that you mentioned the sort of physical reminder of putting something in a place and whether that is safe. Does it occur to you also that this is an entirely digital story in a way, that these are files being moved around, that maybe we should try and put a little bit more value on the digital items that we own?
Yes, absolutely. I think one of the other items on that subject is the personal information that we store on the internet as well. And I think that there has to be a lot more respect for the value of someone's digital files that they're using and obviously our information. As soon as you type it in, then it is uploaded and stored somewhere.
It's a hard way to learn, isn't it, really? But if we want to come and see, I guess, the sort of photography we might want to appreciate, the work that you do, where can we find you online?
My Twitter is @thejmo. And all of my photos are on Flickr, and you can just search for the JMO on there.
Well, we hope that Jay does get his raw files back, and I'm grateful to him for talking to us about his experience. It's good to have a reminder about our information and files online. Take care of what you own and think twice about the reliability of the cloud. Though you may never be in this situation, and we hope this is the case, it's always a really good idea to keep copies of your own files. You never know what might be ahead as the internet changes. Well, thanks to our guests as ever, and of course you too can share your internet adventures or experiments with electrical things. Drop me a line at outriders@bbc.co.uk, tweet at me on Twitter, where we are BBC_Outriders, or search for Outriders on Facebook and Google+, to add us to your feed.
On digital and online.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
bbc.co.uk/5Live.